speaker is Dr. David Larrabee, standing behind me. I'll get out of your way in a moment. He is trained in physics with a PhD and has an MA in theology. He's a professor emeritus of physics at East Stroudsburg University of Pennsylvania. And today he'll be talking about environmental justice, our missing focus. So I'll pass it off to you, David.
Okay. Thank you. And I hope you enjoyed your lunch. Let's see. Oh, come on. How do I go back? Okay. So the Episcopal Book of Common Prayer has several prayers of the people. And Form 6 contains this call and response. And I invite you to respond. For the just and proper use of your creation,
there's hunger, fear,
I love the juxtaposition of creation care with economic and social justice. Ecojustice, my sort of original discipline, originally dealt with the interactions of ecology, economics, and social justice. The poor live lives that are burdened by a multitude of environmental hazards. Those with money can afford to live elsewhere or to mitigate those hazards. The marginalized can be those here within the United States or those in other countries that suffer because of our misuse of creation. It is my position that creation care approaches that do not address existing environmental injustices, or worse, create environmental injustices, are not consistent with the biblical-based Christianity. Consequently, eco-theology needs to confront the abuser of creation as well as respond to the cries for the justice of the victims of that abuse. So I will start by giving a quick argument that the United States collective lifestyle is the leading cause of climate change. Eco-theology should guide us, the developed world, to attempt to reconcile with those whom we have injured. So toward that end, first I will present Niebuhr's typology of differing ideas of what reconciliation means within the public dialogue. So once we have a definition, then I'll examine what a rights-based reconciliation process might look like. To do this, I will draw on the work of Ernest Conradi, who writes from a South African perspective, as well as some others. Reconciliation is not always possible. As an example, I will present and comment on the work of a theologian from Tuvalu, Mina Talia. Finally, I will summarize by looking at what this means for Western ecotheology, especially for the young theologians from the United States. Okay. The development of a technological society is often done on the backs of the poorest. This has been true for at least several millennia. The temple in Israel was built with forced labor. See 1 Kings 5:13. I encourage you to reread the consumption of Solomon in 1 Kings 4:22 to 28 from the point of view of the subsistence farmers and those who worked the king's vineyard. The many provided for the few. We could easily spend the entire weekend on this one topic. So let me present one slide that illustrates the point in today's world. This is a plot of the cumulative emissions of CO2 from 1850 through 2022, expressed as a percentage of the total global emissions during that period. The United States, 5% of the world's population, is responsible for roughly 24% of the cumulative emissions of CO2. Add in Europe, and we have about 10% of the world's population and 40% of the cumulative emissions. We, the United States and Europe, bear a disproportionate share of the blame for greenhouse gas emissions and consequently climate change. We hope to lower our emissions without substantially affecting our lifestyle. Solar panels, windmills, and lithium batteries replacing coal and natural gas-fired electric plants. Internal combustion engines being replaced by electric cars. Used solar panels and worn-out wind turbine blades are going into landfills. The recycling of lithium batteries is still in an infant industry. Protecting our lifestyle comes with an environmental cost. Currently, if the entire planet lived our lifestyle, it would take 5 Earths to support it sustainably. To put it another way, The United States would have to reduce its footprint to 20% of its current value in a just and sustainable world. Eliminating U.S. greenhouse gas emissions would lower that to 1.74 Earths if everyone on the planet lived our lifestyle. So giving rid of CO2 is necessary, but not sufficient. Within the United States, the burdens of environmental hazards falls mainly on the poor and marginalized, referred to now as overburdened communities. These communities have to deal with the cumulative impact of multiple sources of air pollution, as well as their location often near industrial or agricultural hazardous waste producers. The environmental justice movement and some states within the United States are starting to address some of these issues. We also participate in putting an environmental burden on people in less developed countries to get the materials for our technology, like cobalt, lithium, graphite, nickel, silver, copper, gold. For example, I'll give one example. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is the largest producer of cobalt, by far. The lack of environmental controls has created polluted streams, finding its way into fish and people. Workers, sometimes children, are exposed to dangerous conditions within the mines. Also, many less developed countries have very low greenhouse gas emissions, yet they too suffer from the consequences of climate change and sea level rise. Not going to suffer, are currently suffering. There's the impact on indigenous people and their lands as we transition to clean energy. For example, the lithium triangle, parts of Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia, contain a large quantity of high-quality lithium. The technique to get the lithium from the brines puts a strain on local water supplies and local populations, often indigenous. Let me put this in plain English. We are the perpetrators and others are the victims. The United States is an individualistic culture. Consequently, I think we have a hard time with collective guilt and responsibility. We look to individual action to somehow cleanse of collective sin, but the sin remains. An eco-theology in the United States needs to address the process by which perpetrators seek reconciliation with the survivors of our harmful actions. There is no universal definition of reconciliation. Nina Burridge examined how the public use of the word reconciliation describes the desired relationship to indigenous people in Australia. She categorizes the use of the term into three categories, all of which were present in her time. One category equates reconciliation with assimilation. This view affirms the status quo as normative for everyone. In its meaning, the individuality of the indigenous people are lost as they become assimilated into the dominant culture. This is the logic of indigenous children's schools in both the United States and Canada, cultural genocide. In our context, this form of reconciliation would mean that those whom we have harmed are to be brought into our dominant culture, losing their distinctiveness. Therefore, the victim must change, not the perpetrator. Climate change can fall into this trap when we announce that we are all in this together. No, we're not. Another direction was the use of ritual and symbolism to bring the issues to public attention. Reconciliation is a symbolic gesture. Going to a climate change rally gives a satisfaction of having done something. Drafting a document from your organization that acknowledges corporate guilt can be cathartic. Symbolism is important as a communications tool to raise the issue in a public forum. Bringing the issues to public attention is not the same thing as doing something about them. Symbolism is important if it leads to something more substantial. The third use was the identification of rights, treaties, and obligations of the dominant culture to the indigenous people. This is a substantial or rights-based form of reconciliation. It might involve compensation for past wrongs, restitution, acknowledgement of the rights to the land or sea, or it might involve recognizing sovereignty. In the climate change context, this means accepting an obligation to those whom we have wronged. Strong reconciliation holds out the possibility of the establishment of a positive relationship. It seems to me that substantial reconciliation is a definition that is most meaningful within the context of creation care. Are we willing to accept obligation for our past and current ecological damage, change our ways, and offer the restitution that is sought by the survivors? The United States is so far from this point that I would have to answer no. Without a call for substantial reconciliation, without accepting our role as perpetrator, I worry that the U.S. creation care theology morphs into a self-serving exercise in self-justification. So is reconciliation even possible? We need a new blueprint for eco-theology that seeks reconciliation, not just with the planet, but with those whom we have harmed. Looking to our own Western tradition for this blueprint is likely to be counterproductive. We need to look through the eyes of the victim, not the perpetrator. A truth and reconciliation process has been used in several countries with mixed results, but perhaps we can tap into their experience and wisdom. The South African truth and reconciliation process approach to dealing with the end of apartheid was not entirely successful. Ernest Condrady is a theologian who has written extensively on creation care issues as well as relationship to South African experience of apartheid. What follows borrows heavily from his work as well as his students and others. So what is the process by which the perpetrators are reconciled with those whom they have wronged? So I'll go over this briefly. Here's a brief outline of the parts. Confession of guilt and taking responsibility for our sins. Stopping the offending behavior. Offering restitution. Some misnomers. The determination of how much restitution needs to be offered is determined by the victim and not the perpetrator. The deficit always remains. And fourth, the injured party gets to decide whether to continue the relationship in spite of the deficit. I would argue we're not even at the first step. We need to listen to those whom we have wronged. We need to hear what they're going through and start to understand the effects of our action through their hearts, minds, and eyes. After having done this, the empathetic reaction is lament. Lament starts the process of change. The next step is to stop the offending behavior. Reconciliation and justice are not possible if the offending behavior continues. Environmentally, this is more than just reaching net zero, but doing so in a way that doesn't increase the burden on others. Before we go to the communion table, we are told to reconcile with those who we've wronged. Matthew 5, 23 through 26. God might forgive us for our sins against God, but that does not eliminate the responsibility for us to seek reconciliation with our neighbor. The next step is restitution, doing what we can to make right the wrongs. Making funds available to help the poor countries adapt to climate change is only one part of restitution. Funds needed to be made available to allow countries to develop their own industries and infrastructure in their own way. Another part of restitution might be to forgive the debts to the developed world. How much restitution? Restitution is enough when those who have wronged are satisfied that we have done enough. Notice the decision rests with those we have wronged, not those that have created the problem. No restitution can ever fully compensate for the historical wrongs. There is always a deficit. Restitution is always partial. Justice is always partial. If the survivor feels that the relationship to the perpetrator is worth continuing in spite of the deficit, then reconciliation is possible. Notice that the answer is in the hands of those that have been wronged, not the perpetrator. Reestablishment of a relationship makes sense between two individuals who have the option of parting of ways. A wounded country cannot simply break off relationships with those who have created environmental issues for the rest of the world. Relationships continue, even reconciliation is not possible. I would like to reemphasize that the process is largely driven by the victim, not the perpetrator. This cannot happen without engaging the victims of climate injustice. What happens when restitution isn't possible? You cannot reconcile with someone who is dead. Reconciliation is difficult at best if adequate restitution isn't physically possible. Let's look at an example. Sea level rise is endangering a number of Pacific islands in the near future. One such island, Tuvalu, presents a test for international cooperation with respect to the adaptation to sea level rise. The habitable area of Tuvalu, a Pacific Island nation, is getting smaller each year. Tuvalu is a 1,000 miles east of the Solomon Islands, midway between Hawaii and Australia. The country consists of 4 reef islands and 5 coral atolls. Sea level rise and erosion will probably make Tuvalu uninhabitable in the not too distant future. There are several things that make Tuvalu an interesting case. The impact is near term. The population is limited to about 11,000 people with their own language, their own agriculture, and it's an island culture. Tuvalu is largely Protestant Christian. In addition, Tuvalu has a Christian theologian, Mani Atalia, who can articulate a contextual Christian approach to their situation. You might think that the obvious biblical jumping off point would be Noah and the flood. The promise of the flood waters would dissipate and life would continue and never again would there be a global flood. Rather, Mani Atalia turns to the parable of the Good Samaritan with special interest on the innkeeper. Note, very few biblical theologians examine the role of the innkeeper. One thing that the Old Testament theology has in common with many indigenous cultures is the tie to the land. However, in this case, the land is disappearing despite their efforts to save it. How does a culture tied to an island survive without the island? The citizens of Tuvalu haven't given up. If their island has to be evacuated, who will fill the role of the innkeeper? Settling in a new place comes with its own set of problems. They are a collectivist society, so can they resettle as a group to continue their culture and traditions to the extent that they could? Will they be assimilated within another culture? If you relocate them, what do you do about the prior inhabitants of the land in which they settle? This is a test case. If we cannot make it work for the citizens of Tuvalu, how will it work for the millions, perhaps billions, of displaced people and cultures we will see in the future? So far, we're receiving a failing grade. In my estimation, the United States plays the role of the robbers in this parable. We haven't stepped up to the role of the Good Samaritan, and we are actively resisting the possibility of being an innkeeper. Okay. If I had to plead to the next generation of eco-theologians from the developed world, it is this. Find a kindred soul from somewhere from a marginalized country, perhaps someone from an indigenous community or from a country struggling to provide a better standard of living for their people, or someone who is from a community suffering from the burdens of environmental injustice within your own country. Read them, listen to them, and hear them above the noise of the developed world theologians hoping to preserve the status quo. If you cannot cry with them and work to change our behavior, then I question if your theology really is true to the demands of Christ. I end with a quote. There are no free lunches. Someone will pay for a clean environment. It is a belief of this writer that ecology is a profoundly serious matter, yet most of the solutions suggested for environmental quality will have, directly or indirectly, adverse effects on the poor and lower income groups. Hence, economic or distributive justice issues must become an active component in all ecology debates. Reverend Norman Farrelly, 1972. This remains as true as it today as it did in 1972. For the just and proper use of your creation,
for the victims of hunger, fear, injustice, and oppression.
Amen. I'll be happy to take your questions. I'll use my teacher voice.
Well, keep using the microphone just to make sure that everyone is active.
Yes.
So thank you for that. I'll stand up so you can hear me. I'm from South Louisiana. My husband is a pastor. So we both have people that work for the oil and gas industry, and those affected very directly by land loss and climate change. Mm. And so my question for you is, as a local church, how can we engage the victims?
That's a great question.
David, I'll just ask you to take a couple steps that direction. Perfect.
it's a great question, and it has to be handled with care. because it could be done from a place of privilege. If you ask somebody, you sort of demand that you tell me what you're feeling, is cannot be a demand. I'll give you a personal thing. I work for the group's Sustainable Jersey City, and we've started to get involved into the environmental justice movement there, which is mostly in a neighboring city. Now, we have some minorities, but not a lot. So our approach was very simple. We have two hands, we have an audience, we have the ability to reach the administration. Tell us how we can help, okay? And build a relationship of trust. And then we make what we have available to the EJ community, sort of Newark and Elizabeth. And that works. If we just try to launch out on our own, it's not gonna work. So build trust. Two hands, 2 feet, resources, yeah.
For the sake of time, I think this will be our last question, actually, just so we can have some minutes to transition.
I love your thought about kind of an interim solution of us individually adopting someone who is deaf. But do you know if there's any clearinghouse, or is anybody setting up a mechanism for that, or are we left to our own devices to find?
So my comment is that they're screaming at the rooftops. Their journals, the South African journals, Australian journals, one of the leading biblical scholars on environmental issues is Australian. And most people in the US don't know them. So I don't think it's a matter of trying to clear us. Google is a great resource. I mean, it's the only way you're not gonna hear them is if you're not looking to hear them.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point to conclude on. So please join me in thanking Dr. Mary.